Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are attempting something slightly ambitious.
Slightly.
Okay, you're right. Scratch that. It's massively ambitious. We're trying to solve a puzzle that, it spans 3 centuries.
It really does.
We're going to take the entire economic history of India from, the colonial drain of wealth in the 1800s all the way to the digital manufacturing boom we're living through right now in 2026.
And if that wasn't enough, we're going to overlay it with the mathematical precision of international trade theory.
It sounds like we're mixing oil and water, doesn't
A
it?
little bit, yeah. History is messy, it's emotional, it's full of famine and politics.
And trade theory is, well, it's cold. It's algebraic, logical.
But here's the insight, and this is the key. You cannot understand the Indian economy of today, why we export software, why we import so much oil, or why the 2026 GDP is growing at 7.4% without understanding how those two things collided.
Exactly. And for our listeners, specifically the learners, whether you're cramming for the CUDPG, prepping for the civil services, or you just want to understand the machinery behind the budget, this is your cheat sheet. Our mission today is to move beyond just, rote memorization. We don't want you to just know who Dadabhai Nauroji was.
We want you to understand the logic of his arguments, why they were so powerful.
Yes. We want to turn these abstract theorems and these old books into a narrative that actually sticks.
We are going to connect the dots. We're going to see how a famine in 1866 led, believe it or not, to bureaucratic structures we still use today. And we're going to see how a paradox, a puzzle discovered in 1953 by a Russian-American economist, actually helps explain why Bangalore became the IT capital of the world.
Speaking of that paradox, let's start there. That's the hook. This is the thing that kept me up last night while I was going through the research stack. It's called the Leontief paradox.
Ah, Wassily Leontief. 1953. This is one of the most famous uh-oh moments in the entire history of economics.
So, okay, here's the setup. The standard economic theory, the one everyone learns in Econ 101, says that a country will export things based on what it has a lot of.
Right. It's called factor endowments.
So if you have a lot of capital money, machines, infrastructure, you export capital-intensive goods. If you have a lot of labor, people, you export labor-intensive goods. Simple.
It's the Heckscher-Ohlin model. It's elegant. It makes perfect intuitive sense. You sell what you have in abundance.
But then Leontief runs the numbers on the United States in 1953. Now remember, post-World War II, America is the richest, most capital-abundant country on Earth. So the model predicts they should be exporting airplanes, heavy machinery, all that stuff.
They should be exporting capital.
But the data said no. The U.S. was exporting labor-intensive goods.
It was a shock. It completely broke the model.
It just shattered it.
It was an empirical bombshell. It suggested that the fundamental math of how nations trade was just wrong. But the solution to that paradox, which we'll definitely unravel later, is actually the key to understanding modern India.
How so?
Because it turns out labor isn't just a headcount, it's about human capital, skills,
Yeah.
education.
Ah, I see. That is the thread we are going to pull on. So here's our roadmap for today.
Let's lay it out.
Part one, the architects of colonial economic history, the men who first calculated the cost of empire. Part two, the mechanics of that extraction, how the land revenue systems and the famines literally broke the rural back of India. Part three, the intellectual roots of independence and the whole planning era. And then finally, parts four and five.
This is where we get into the math.
Exactly. We're going to deep dive into trade theory, Ricardo, Heckscher-Ohlin, Krugman, and we're going to apply it to the hard data from the 2025-26 economic survey.
It's a journey from the drain of wealth to what you might call the digital surplus. Let's get into it.
Let's do it. So part one, the colonial era. If you're a student, this is usually just a dry list of books and dates. But let's look at these figures as what they were.
They were the first data scientists of the resistance.
That's a great way to put it. And we have to start with the grand old man, Dadabhai Nauroji.
Nauroji is the giant. Everyone else stands on his shoulders. You have to remember the context. In the mid-19th century, the official British narrative was that they were civilizing India, bringing progress.
Right, the white man's burden.
Exactly. And Nauroji was the one who decided to, check the receipts. His seminal work is Poverty and Un-British Rule in India, which came out in 1901.
And that title itself is just a masterclass in sarcasm, isn't it? Un-British Rule.
It's devastatingly clever.
He's essentially telling the British, you claim to be all about fairness and justice and rule of law, But what you're doing in India is the complete opposite of your own values.
Precisely. But his real contribution wasn't just rhetoric, it was accounting. He developed the drain of wealth theory.
The drain of wealth.
He argued that British rule wasn't just political control, it was a vast economic pump, systematically extracting surplus from India and sending it to London. And he identified the specific mechanism, something called home charges.
Home charges. It sounds so innocuous, like a utility bill or some subscription fee you forgot to cancel.
And that's exactly what it was designed to sound like. But these were payments India was forced to make to Britain for things like administrative costs in London,
okay,
pensions for retired British officers who were living a comfortable life back in England.
Wow.
And, this is the most perverse part, interest on debt that Britain itself had incurred in order to conquer India.
Wait, wait, so India was essentially paying the interest on the loan used to oppress itself?
Correct. It's a perfect vicious cycle of extraction. He also tracked something called council bills, which were these complex financial instruments used to actually transfer the cash. But Naroji's true genius, I think, was in how he calculated poverty.
Because there was no official data,
right?
Right? The British didn't want to know.
Of course not. So how do you measure poverty in a complete data vacuum? This is where he gets creative.
Use the jail cost of living. This is my favorite detail in the entire research stack. I think it's just brilliant.
It is brilliant forensic economics. Naroji got his hands on the official records of what the British fed prisoners in jail. He looked at the official diet. Rice, flour, dal, mutton, vegetables, ghee, salt. A basic but life-sustaining diet.
And what?
He went to the market, priced out all these items, and calculated the absolute minimum cost for a person to survive based on the government's own prisoner rations.
The logic being,
yeah,
if a free Indian citizen cannot even afford the diet of a convicted prisoner, they are living in absolute undeniable destitution.
Exactly. It set a scientific, biological floor for poverty that was impossible for the British to argue against. And based on this, he came up with a number. He estimated the per capita income in 1867-68 was just 20.
20 rupees. A year.
A year.
That number must have shocked the world. It completely turned that benevolent empire narrative on its head.
It did. It gave the nationalist movement its economic foundation.
Okay, so that's Naroji. Next up in this group, we have R.C. Dutt.
Ramesh Chunderdutt. He was actually a high-ranking civil servant in the British administration before he became a historian.
So he saw the system from the inside.
He did. His magnum opus is The Economic History of India, which came out in two volumes, in 1902 and 1904.
So if Naroji is the drain guy, what's Dutt's signature focus? How do we, you know, for an exam, how do we differentiate them?
It's a great question. While Naroji focused on the financial drain and the big macro numbers, Dutt really drilled down into the agrarian crisis. He looked at the land.
Okay.
He argued that the constant devastating famines, which were killing millions of people, were not acts of God. They weren't just about failed monsoons.
They were policy failures.
Yes. He attacked the land revenue settlements. He argued that the tax rates were so crushingly high that peasants could never save any surplus. So when a drought inevitably hit, they had no buffer, they had no savings, they just died.
And he also gave us that famous half estimate regarding the drain, right?
He did. Dutt's calculation was that roughly one half of India's net revenues flowed out of the country every single year. One half. Imagine running a business where 50% of your revenue is just taken out of the cash register every single night and set on fire. Your business would never grow.
No, it would collapse.
And that's what he argued was happening to the Indian economy. It was being bled dry.
Okay, and to round out this initial trinity of economic nationalists, we have M.G. Renade.
Justice Mahadev Govind Renade. His key text is Essays on Indian Economics, published in 1898. Renade is fascinating because he was the theoretical rebel. He was what we'd now call an institutionalist.
An institutionalist.
Yeah.
What does that mean? How is he different from Naroji or Dutt?
So Naroji and Dutt were, in a way, arguing within the British system. They were using British methods, British data, to show the unfairness of British rule.
Okay.
Renade attacked the theory itself. The British justified their policies using Adam Smith and the idea of laissez-faire, you know, let the market rule.
Hands off, the free market will solve everything.
Right. And Renade said, stop. He argued that these so-called universal economic laws do not exist. You cannot just copy and paste the economics of industrial England onto the caste-based, agrarian, monsoon-dependent reality of India.
So he was basically the first to say context matters.
He was. And it was a radical idea at the time. He argued for state intervention. He said the Indian government, or what passed for it, needed to protect its infant industries.
The infant industry argument.
His analogy was brilliant. He said if you throw a baby into a boxing ring with a heavyweight champion, which was Indian handicrafts versus British machine goods, the baby dies. You have to protect the baby, nurture it until it's strong enough to compete.
And you can draw a direct line from that argument in 1898 to the protectionist policies India adopted in the 1950s and 60s.
A straight, unbroken line.
Okay, so those are the big theorists, but we also need to talk about the data crunchers, the statisticians who tried to put even harder numbers on this stagnation.
Right. We mentioned Naroji's 20 estimate. Later on, you had William Digby in 1899. He was a British journalist who was actually very sympathetic to the Indian nationalist cause. He used a bunch of indirect indicators to estimate the drain at about $30 million a year.
But the real scientific leap forward, the name that really matters for modern national accounting, came with Dr. V.K.R.V. Rao.
Yes, Dr. Rao, the scientist.
Why is he so important? For someone taking an exam, why is V.K.R.V. Rao a name you have to know?
Because Rao provided the first truly scientific estimate of national income for the years 1925-29 and then again for 1931-32. Before him, as you said, it was a lot of inspired guesswork. He introduced what's called the bifurcation method.
Bifurcation, so splitting the economy into two parts.
Exactly. He had this key insight that you can't measure a farm the same way you measure a factory or a lawyer's office.
Different methods for different sectors.
Precisely. So for the primary sector, agriculture, forestry, fishing, he used the census of output. He literally tried to count the physical stuff being produced. Tons of wheat, bales of cotton. But for the corporate and service sectors, that doesn't work. So there he used the census of income, counting salaries, profits, what people were actually earning.
It sounds so obvious now, but combining those two methodologies for the first time must have been revolutionary.
It was. It gave us the first high-fidelity picture of the Indian economy, and the picture it painted was bleak.
What did he find?
He proved, with hard data, that real output growth was almost stagnant, around 2%. And because the population was growing, per capita growth was basically zero. 0.5%. The economy was essentially frozen in time.
A half a percent, that's just nothing.
It's a rounding error. It proved the nationalists' point.
Which brings us to the big debate that still rages in history departments. Deindustrialization. Did the British actually destroy Indian industry, or is that just, you know, nationalist propaganda?
This is the classic he said, she said of Indian economic history. It's a fantastic debate.
So lay out the two sides for us.
On the nationalist side, you have people like R.C. Dutt and later the historian Bipan Chandra. Their argument is pretty straightforward. Cheap, machine-made British textiles flooded the Indian market.
And they undercut the local handloom weavers.
Exactly. The weavers and artisans lost their jobs and were forced to go back into agriculture, which was already overcrowded. This increased the pressure on the land and made famines worse.
And Bipan Chandra used import data to prove this. Right. I remember this detail.
He did. It was very clever. He showed that the import of finished cloth shirts, dresses skyrocketed. But the import of yarn or thread didn't keep pace. If Indians were still weaving, they would have been buying the imported British yarn. But they weren't buying yarn. They were buying finished shirts. That's the smoking gun that implies the local looms had stopped working.
Okay, that's a powerful argument. So what was the counter argument? The revisionist view.
This was led by an American historian named Morris D. Morris. And he called deindustrialization a myth.
A myth. How did he argue that?
His argument was all about the demand side. He said, look, the Indian population was growing and British imports were making clothes cheaper. So the total size of the market for textiles was expanding very rapidly.
Okay.
And he argued that this new, bigger market was large enough to absorb both the cheap British imports and the traditional Indian goods. He said they were basically different products for different customers. A wealthy person might buy an import. A poor farmer would still buy local.
So who is right? The data seems to favor the nationalists.
Well, the knockout blow, the study that really settled the debate for most historians, came from Amiya Kumar Bakshi.
What did Bakshi do?
He did a deep, micro-level study of the Gangetic Bihar region over a long period. And his data is just devastating. He found that the share of the population engaged in industrial employment collapsed from 62.3% in 1809 to just 15.1% in 1901.
62% down to 15.
Yes. That is not a market adjustment. That is not a myth. That is a demolition. The workforce was fundamentally deindustrialized.
That settles that then. Okay, let's move to part two. We've talked about the drain theory, but we need to get into the weeds of how they actually well, how they got the money out of the peasants.
The machinery of extraction.
Right. And this brings us to the land tenure systems, the three revenue traps.
This is absolutely crucial to understanding rural India even today. The British basically ran three different experiments to see how they could maximize revenue from the land, and all three were disastrous in their own unique ways.
Let's start with the first one, the Zamindari system. This is also called the Permanent Settlement, 1793, Lord Cornwallis. This covered Bengal, Bihar, and Odisha.
The key word there for anyone studying this is permanent. The British fixed the amount of revenue the government would demand from a piece of land forever.
And they created a class of intermediaries to collect it, right? The zamindars.
Exactly. The British didn't want to deal with millions of individual farmers, so they made these zamindars the legal owners of the land, and their job was to collect rent from the peasants and pay the fixed tax to the state.
Now, on paper, this sounds like it might encourage investment. If my tax is fixed forever and I improve the farm to make more money, I get to keep all the extra profit.
That was the theory. That was the Adam Smith logic behind it. But the reality was completely different. The state's share of the rent was fixed at 1/111th. It was so incredibly high.
10 out of 11 parts.
Yes. It was so high that the zamindars had no incentive to invest. They became what we call absentee landlords. They didn't farm. They lived in lavish mansions in Calcutta and just had agents who would go out and squeeze the tenants for every last drop of rent. There was no connection to the soil, only to the cash.
Okay, so that's system one. What was system number two?
System two was the Ryotwari system. This started around 1820, championed by Thomas Monroe and Alexander Reed. It was implemented in Madras, Bombay, and parts of Assam.
And the big difference here?
Here, they decided to eliminate the middleman. The government would make a deal directly with the ryot, which is the word for peasant or cultivator.
Which sounds better, right? No middleman taking a cut.
It sounds fairer, but it was arguably even harsher. First, the tax rates weren't permanent. They were revised every 20 or 30 years, and they were almost always revised upward.
Oh.
And they were often set at an exorbitant 50 to 60% of the gross produce. But the crucial, brutal part was that you had to pay in cash, regardless of the harvest.
Oh, wow.
So if the monsoon failed and your crop died, you still owed the British government a fixed amount of cash on a fixed date.
And where does a peasant get cash during a drought?
The only place they can, the village moneylender.
So the Ryotwari system created a massive, inescapable debt trap.
Exactly. And it led to a huge transfer of land ownership from the actual farmers to the non-farming moneylenders.
Okay. And the third system?
The third experiment was the Mahalwari system from 1822. This was Holt McKenzie's idea, and it was used in Punjab, the northwest frontier, and parts of central India.
So it was a Mahal.
A Mahal was defined as an estate or a village or a group of villages. This was the community approach. The unit of tax assessment wasn't the individual farmer, but the village as a whole.
So the village headman was responsible for collecting the tax and handing it over.
Yes, the village community was held jointly responsible. But again, the story is the same. The tax rates were exorbitant, and the system was rigid and inflexible.
So whether it was Zamindari, Ryotwari, or Mahalwari, the end result for the peasant was the same.
They were squeezed.
And when you squeeze a peasant who relies entirely on the rain, you get famine.
The 19th century in India was the century of famines. And the British response to these famines was, well, it was incredibly bureaucratic. They set up a series of famine commissions.
It's just such a grim irony, isn't it? People are starving to death by the million. Let's form a committee. But for the exams, we need to know the evolution of these commissions.
Right. And you can see a slow, painful progression from reluctance to some sense of responsibility.
Where does it start?
It starts with the Campbell Commission in 1866. After the terrible Orissa famine. And this was the first time the British administration officially admitted, okay, maybe the government has a duty to save lives. Before this, the hardline laissez-faire view was that interfering would just make people lazy.
So that was the first crack in the dam. What's next?
The big one. The one everyone needs to remember is the Strachey Commission of 1880, led by Sir Richard Strachey.
Why is this one so crucial?
Because it created the Famine Code of 1883. This was basically a rule book, a manual for what to do in a disaster. It institutionalized a set of relief measures.
What kind of measures?
It said, when a famine is officially declared, you must suspend revenue collection, and you must start public works programs, building roads, digging canals to give able-bodied people jobs so they can earn money to buy food. Mm. It was a huge step.
It codified a government response.
Exactly. Then, in 1900, after another series of famines, you get the McDonnell Commission. This introduced the idea of a moral strategy.
A moral strategy, what does that mean?
It meant being more proactive. Appoint a specific famine commissioner for each province. Distribute seeds and loans early, before the worst hits. Try to get ahead of the crisis.
And finally, we jump forward to the Woodhead Commission in 1944. This was investigating the last great famine. The Bengal famine.
Woodhead is controversial, but very important. He didn't just blame the weather. He blamed the famine on wartime inflation, on widespread hoarding by merchants, and on a breakdown of transport.
And this investigation, this laid the intellectual groundwork for a much more famous theory, didn't it?
It absolutely did. The findings of the Woodhead Commission were a direct precursor to what Amartya Sen would later call his entitlement failure hypothesis.
Let's pivot to that now, part three. The intellectual foundation of the new independent India. We mentioned Nauroji, but we have to talk about B.R. Ambedkar as an economist.
Yes, it's so important. People know Ambedkar the jurist, the father of the Constitution, but his PhDs from Columbia and the London School of Economics were in economics.
And in 1923, he wrote a book called A Problem of the Rupee. What was his argument?
He was decades ahead of his time. He attacked the currency standards of the day. He argued that the British were deliberately manipulating the exchange rate, specifically something called the gold exchange standard, to create inflation in India.
And why was he so focused on inflation?
Because he asked the crucial question, who does inflation hurt the most? It hurts the poor, the Dalits, people with no assets whose only income is their daily wage. He saw monetary policy not as a technical issue, but as a tool of social oppression.
He also wrote another book, The Evolution of Provincial Finance, which is basically the foundational text for fiscal federalism in India.
Right. It analyzes how the central government historically starved the provinces of funds. And this is an issue we are still debating, I mean literally right now, with the 16th Finance Commission and its devolution formula. Ambedkar saw that if the provinces didn't have their own sources of money, they would always be slaves to the center.
Incredible foresight. And then in the post-independence era, we have the modern development giants, Gunnar Myrdal and Amartya Sen.
Myrdal, a Swedish economist, wrote the epic book Asian Drama in 1968. His big idea was circular cumulative causation.
Poverty trap.
Essentially, yes. The idea that poverty breeds more poverty in a self-perpetuating downward spiral. It takes a massive external push to break the cycle.
And then, of course, Amartya Sen with Poverty and Famines in 1981.
And this connects directly back to the Bengal famine we just mentioned.
Right. So what was his entitlement failure hypothesis?
Sen's Nobel-winning insight was this. He studied the Bengal famine and found that, in most areas, there was actually enough food available in the region. There was no absolute shortage of rice.
So why did millions starve?
They starved, not because there was no food, but because they lost their entitlement to the food, their economic power to buy it. A fisherman couldn't sell his fish, so he couldn't buy rice. A barber had no customers, so he couldn't buy rice. It changed how we look at hunger forever. It's about purchasing power, not just the harvest yield.
It's an economic problem, not an agricultural one.
Right.
Okay, let's move from the world of ideas to the era of action. 1951, the planning era begins in India.
The first five-year plan, this was based on the Haridomar model. It was a very simple, straightforward model.
What was the focus?
The focus was on agriculture, irrigation, and boosting the domestic savings rate. The idea was that savings equals investment, and investment drives growth. And you know what? It worked pretty well.
But the second plan, that was the one that changed everything.
1956. The Nehru-Mahalanobis model, P.C. Mahalanobis, a brilliant physicist and statistician, was the architect. He believed India's future lay in heavy industry.
And the logic here was import substitution, right?
Yes. Completely. The thinking was, why should we buy machines from the West? Let's build the factories that make the machines that make the goods. So massive investment in steel plants, dams, heavy engineering.
And to do that, you had to close the Indian economy to foreign competition.
Exactly. High tariffs, import quotas. This created the infamous license Raj, where you needed a government permit to do almost anything.
And that whole system chugged along with slowing growth rates until the wheels completely fell off in 1991. The crisis.
It was the perfect storm. We had a twin deficit crisis, A high fiscal deficit, meaning the government was spending way more than it earned.
And a balance of payments crisis.
We were running out of foreign currency, out of dollars.
Yeah.
Then the first Gulf War hit, the price of oil skyrocketed, and remittances from Indian workers in the Gulf dried up.
How bad did it get?
We had about 2 weeks of import cover left. We physically had to airlift our gold reserves to the Bank of England as collateral to get an emergency loan.
It was a moment of national humiliation, but it was also the catalyst. It forced the reforms. And this gives us two key committees that you absolutely must know for any exam. Narasimham and Chilya.
These two are the architects of the modern Indian economy.
Let's take them one by one. The Narasimham Committee.
Narasimham Committee in 1991 was all about fixing the banking sector. It recommended lowering the SLR and CRR.
Okay, what are those?
The statutory liquidity ratio and the cash reserve ratio. They were rules that forced banks to keep a huge chunk of their money locked up with the government. Narasimham said, lower these. Let the banks lend that money to businesses. He also said to deregulate interest rates and clean up the bad loans, the NPAs.
And the other one, the Raja Chelya Committee.
Chelya Committee, also 1991, was about fixing taxes. He was a big believer in the Laffer curve logic.
The idea that if you cut tax rates, you can actually increase tax revenue.
Exactly. He argued if you tax people at 90%, they will hide their income. If you tax them at a reasonable 30%, they'll be more likely to pay it. So he recommended lowering the top marginal rates and broadening the tax base. He also introduced the initial concept of a value-added tax, or VAT.
And there's one more key piece of legislation from this era, the FRBM Act of 2003.
The Fiscal Responsibility and Budget Management Act, this was huge. This was basically the government tying its own hands to prevent future crises. It set statutory targets, a glide path for reducing the fiscal deficit.
But the most important part was about the RBI, wasn't it?
Yes. Crucially, it ended the automatic monetization of debt. Before this, the government could just force the RBI to print more rupees to finance its deficit. The FRBM Act stopped that. It created a separation between fiscal and monetary policy.
Okay. Wow. We have covered a century and a half of history. We understand the drain, the famine code, the license Raj, and the reforms. Now, let's switch gears completely. Let's enter the engine room.
International trade theory.
This is the logic that explains why countries buy and sell things from each other in the first place.
And we have to start with the classics, the foundation. Adam Smith, 1776, The Wealth of Nations.
Smith gave us the theory of absolute advantage.
It's the most intuitive, common sense idea. If country A can make shoes faster, better than country B, and country B can make wine faster and better than country A,
then they should trade. Country A makes all the shoes, country B makes all the wine, they swap, and both are better off.
It's a positive sum game. Everyone wins. Simple.
But then, along came David Ricardo in 1817. He wrote on the principles of political economy and taxation. And he had an aha moment that basically changed everything.
Ricardo spotted a massive flaw in Smith's theory. He asked, what if country A is better and faster at making everything? What if Portugal is more efficient at making both wine and cloth than England is?
Under Smith's theory, they shouldn't trade. Portugal should just make everything itself.
Exactly. But Ricardo said, no, that's wrong. They should still trade.
And this is his theory of comparative advantage.
Correct. And it's all based on one of the most powerful concepts in all of economics, opportunity cost.
Okay. You used the lawyer typist analogy before we started. Let's use that. Walk us through it.
Okay. Imagine a top corporate lawyer. She's the best lawyer in the city. And just by chance, she's also the fastest typist in the city. She's better at law and better at typing than her secretary. She has an absolute advantage in both.
So should the lawyer type her own legal briefs?
Absolutely not, because every hour she spends typing is an hour she isn't spending in court or advising clients, where she can bill, say, $500 an hour. The secretary might only be worth $50 an hour.
So the opportunity cost of her typing is the $500 she's giving up.
You've got it. So even though she is a better typist, she has a comparative advantage in law. She should specialize in law and trade for the typing services. Nations are exactly the same. Even if one country is better at everything, it should still specialize in what it is most efficient at, relatively speaking, and trade for the rest.
That is the foundation of all modern trade theory. But then in the 20th century, we got a lot more mathematical about it.
We did. This brings us to neoclassical theory, specifically the Heckscher-Ohlin model.
Named after two Swedish economists, Eli Heckscher, who came up with the idea in 1919, and his student, Bertil Ohlin, who refined it in 1933.
Right, and they made a crucial shift. Ricardo's model was all about differences in technology or productivity. Hechscher and Olin shifted the focus to resource endowment.
What a country has. This is also called the factor proportions theory.
Right. They laid out a simple, elegant 2x2x2 world, two countries, two goods, and two factors of production, capital and labor.
And the theory is beautifully simple.
It is. A country will export the good that makes intensive use of the factor it has in abundance.
So translate that. India has a lot of people, a lot of labor. So it should export labor-intensive goods like textiles or garments.
Perfect. And a country like, say, Germany has a lot of capital machinery, advanced factories. It should export capital-intensive goods like high-end cars.
It's intuitive. And this model gives us three very famous corollaries, the so what theorems that follow from this logic.
Let's run through them. For anyone studying, you need to know these three.
Okay, first up, the Stolper-Samuelson theorem.
This one is all about the politics of trade. It's powerful. It says that opening up to free trade benefits the abundant factor of production and hurts the scarce factor.
Okay, an example.
In India, labor is the abundant factor. Capital is scarce. So when India opens up to trade, workers labor when their wages should go up because there's more demand for what they do. But the owners of capital might lose as they now face competition from cheaper capital-intensive imports.
And in the U.S. or Europe, it's the opposite. Trade helps capital, but can hurt the wages of low-skilled labor.
Which is exactly why labor unions in rich countries often oppose free trade agreements. Stolper-Samuelson explains that political conflict perfectly.
Okay, theorem number two, the Rybczynski theorem.
This one is about what happens when your endowments change, when you get more of one factor. Let's say a country experiences a big wave of immigration. The labor force increases.
Okay.
The theorem says that your output of the labor-intensive good will go up more than proportionately to the increase in labor. But, and here's the really weird and counterintuitive part, your output of the other good, the capital-intensive one, will actually shrink.
So more workers means more shirts, but fewer cars.
In that simple model, yes. The factors of production get reallocated.
And the third one, factor price equalization.
This is the big long-run prediction of the model. It says that over time, free trade in goods will act as a perfect substitute for the migration of people or capital. Trade alone will eventually cause the wages for similar labor and the rents for similar capital to become equal across all trading countries.
Which is a pretty staggering prediction.
It is, and it almost never fully happens in the real world, but the tendency is there.
Okay, so that's the theory. The Hechscher-Olin model, or HO model, rules the world of economics for decades. But then, as we said at the start, Wassily Leontief runs the data in 1953.
And he breaks it. The Leontief paradox. He tested the HO model on the U.S. economy, the most capital-abundant country in the world, and the data showed the U.S. was exporting labor-intensive goods and importing capital-intensive ones.
The complete opposite of the prediction. It defied the textbook. Why? What was the solution to the paradox?
There were a few resolutions. The most important one was that the simple model of capital versus labor was too simple. It wasn't just labor. It was skilled labor, human capital.
So American workers were highly educated, highly skilled.
Exactly. And that human capital is a form of capital itself. So the U.S. wasn't exporting simple labor. It was exporting goods made with highly skilled, productive human capital. The other reason was trade policy. The U.S. was heavily protecting its own labor-intensive industries with tariffs, which distorted the import data.
Okay. So the paradox led to a refinement of the theory. And that brings us to the modern era of trade, part five. Because the HO model still couldn't explain everything. For example, why do the U.S. and Germany trade so many cars with each other?
That's the perfect question. It's called inter-industry trade. The HO model is about countries with different endowments trading different things. It has nothing to say about why two rich, similar countries would swap, you know, BMWs for Fords.
And this is where Paul Krugman enters the chat in 1979 with New Trade Theory, or NTT.
For which he won the Nobel Prize. His solution was brilliant because it was so simple. He introduced two real-world concepts into the model.
What were they?
First, economies of scale. The idea that as you produce more of something, the cost per unit goes down. And second, what he called love of variety.
Love of variety.
We don't just trade for resources or because of endowments. We trade for choice. You might really want a German-engineered BMW. I might prefer an American Ford Mustang. By trading, both countries get access to a wider variety of cars.
And the economies of scale part means that Ford and BMW can each build huge, efficient factories serving a global market, making both cars cheaper than they would be otherwise.
That's new trade theory in a nutshell.
And we also have another idea from this era, the Linder hypothesis.
Stefan Bernstam Linder, another Swede, in 1961, he looked at the demand side. He basically said, forget endowments. Trade happens between countries with similar levels of per capita income.
Rich countries trade with other rich countries.
And poor countries trade with other poor countries because their citizens demand similar types of goods at similar quality levels. It's called overlapping demand. It explains why most global trade happens between North America, Europe, and East Asia.
And the newest kid on the block, new trade theory, Mark Mallett's 2003. This is even more recent.
This is the cutting edge. Mallett's added one more dose of reality, firm heterogeneity.
Meaning all firms are not the same.
Exactly. Before him, trade models basically assumed all firms in a country's car industry were identical. Mallett said, no, that's crazy. Some firms are superstars, like Toyota. Some are small and weak.
And his big insight was about exporting.
His insight was that exporting is expensive. You have to do market research, set up distribution, deal with regulations. These are sunk costs. Only the most productive, most efficient firms in an industry can actually afford to pay those costs and export.
So what does trade do?
Trade acts like a Darwinian selection mechanism. When you open up to trade, the weak, unproductive firms that can't compete die off. The superstar firms that can export grow bigger and stronger. This raises the average productivity of the whole industry.
It's survival of the fittest exporters.
That's a perfect way to put it.
And really quickly, before we finally get to the modern data, there's one more tool we should mention. Offer curves.
Ah, yes. The work of Alfred Marshall and Francis Edgeworth. An offer curve is also called a reciprocal demand curve.
What does it show?
It's a graph that shows how much of your own export good you are willing to give up in order to get a certain amount of an imported good. You have one curve for each country where the two curves cross.
That's your equilibria. That determines the final price, the terms of trade.
Exactly. It's the point where both countries' desires are mutually satisfied.
Okay. We have the history. We have the theory. Now let's look at the reality. Part 6. The contemporary snapshot of the Indian economy. We are looking at data from the 2025-26 economic survey and the FY27 budget.
This is the payoff. Let's see how the theories match up with the real world. Let's start with the macro dashboard.
Growth. What are the headline numbers?
Real GDP growth is estimated at a very strong 7.4% for fiscal year 26. Nominal GDP, which includes inflation, is at 8.0%.
Okay, what about the government's finances? Fiscal health.
This is a really interesting story. The government is on a strict consolidation glide path. The fiscal deficit target for FY27 is 4.3% of GDP.
But the really amazing number you told me is the primary deficit.
It is. The primary deficit has collapsed to just 0.7% of GDP. Now, what that means is that almost all of our government borrowing now is just to pay interest on old debt. We are basically not borrowing for our day-to-day expenses anymore.
That's a huge structural transformation.
It's a sign of a much healthier, more mature economy.
What about the sectoral shift? Where is the growth coming from?
The story continues to be the rise of the service sector. Services now make up 56.4% of our gross value added, or GVA. Agriculture is growing at a steady but slower 3.1%, but within agriculture, there's a diversification happening.
What do you mean?
Crop cultivation is growing slowly, but livestock and fisheries are booming. That's a sign of rising incomes. People are consuming more protein.
Let's talk taxation. We mentioned Raj Acilia's reforms earlier. How does the tax picture look now in 2026?
The reforms have really paid off. Direct taxes, income tax, and corporate tax now make up more than 60% of the central government's total revenue.
And which tax is the biggest generator?
This is a recent shift. Personal income tax is now the single largest source of revenue. That's 33%. It has overtaken both corporate tax and the GST.
And here we can apply some of those public economics theories we touched on. Concepts like deadweight loss and the Ramsey rule.
We can. Deadweight loss, also called the Harberger triangle, is the economic inefficiency that any tax creates. The Ramsey rule is a principle for how to minimize that loss.
And what does it say?
The Ramsey rule says that for maximum efficiency, you should place higher taxes on goods with inelastic demand.
So things people have to buy regardless of the price, like medicine or salt.
Exactly. But there's a huge catch, and it's all about equity. Inelastic goods are often necessities, so if you put a high tax on food, you hurt the poor disproportionately. Modern tax policy is a constant balancing act between the Ramsey rule for efficiency and the need for fairness and equity.
Okay. the moment of truth. Let's look at the trade profile for 2025-26.
Total exports are projected at $825.3 billion, a huge number. But the interesting part is what we are exporting.
What are the top items?
The top items now are refined petroleum products and, get this, electronics. The electronics export numbers are surging, and that's a direct result of the government's PLI, or production-linked incentive, schemes.
And on the other side of the ledger, what are we importing?
No surprises here. Number one is crude oil. That's our big inelastic weakness. Then electronic components, a lot of which go into those exported electronics. And as always, gold.
And who are our main trading partners?
The U.S. is our biggest partner overall, and we consistently run a trade surplus with them. China is our biggest source of imports, and we run a massive persistent deficit with them. And the UAE is becoming increasingly important as a gateway to the Middle East and Europe.
So let's synthesize all of this. What does it all mean? We've gone from Dadabhai Nauroji's estimate of 20 per capita income and the drain of wealth
to a $4 trillion economy that is exporting smartphones.
How do you connect that whole journey?
It's an incredible journey of resilience. We started with a colonial economy that was explicitly designed for extraction. We went through a long, inward-looking period of closed, protectionist planning under the Mahalanobis model.
The license round.
Then the 1991 crisis acted as a shock therapy, forcing us to embrace the market and open up to the world, following the roadmap of Narasimhan and Chalia. And now, with the lens of modern theories like Malitz and Krugman, we see an India that is finally integrating into global value chains.
Let's connect the theory directly. The Stolper-Samuelson theorem seems to explain why wages in our IT and service sector are rising so fast.
It does. Skilled labor, or human capital, is our new abundant factor. And when we trade it with the world, its returns wages go up.
And Leon Tieff's focus on human capital, his solution to the paradox.
It perfectly explains why India managed to do something very unusual. We largely skipped the low-end manufacturing phase and jumped straight from an agrarian economy to a service-based one.
So here is a final provocative thought for you to chew on. The classic Heckscher-Ohlin model says the developing country should start with labor-intensive manufacturing, making shirts, shoes, toys.
The path China took.
Exactly. India, as we said, leaps straight from agriculture to services IT, consulting, business practice outsourcing. Does this mean India defies the textbooks? Or are we seeing the emergence of a new kind of comparative advantage, a service-led advantage defined not by factories and ports, but by digital infrastructure and a huge pool of English-speaking graduates?
That is the trillion-dollar question for the next decade. If India can successfully pull that off, we might have to rewrite the development textbooks all over again.
To our listeners, especially the learners out there, don't look at this long list of authors and theorems as just trivia for your exam. They are the tools. They're the lenses you need to understand this incredible evolving story.
The story of how a country went from a 20 per capita colony to a nearly $4 trillion powerhouse. Keep connecting those dots.
Thanks for listening. Keep diving deep.